Good morning, welcome back. Let you start. Questions, problems, worries, fears, anything on your list today? The brain. Let's start off with how we get there, a little development. At about 18 days after fertilization, we have this beginning of it. It's called a primitive streak. It looks like somebody has taken a Sharpie and simply drawn a line down the back of the embryo, and it is a... if it was, looks like a line, that is something, or this is sort of the sideways view of the line, or the top view, because it's just a line. But what happens at this point in time is that the outer layers of the embryo begin to thicken, and it sort of forms a plate. And as it happens, then the edges begin to roll up. And what happens to this middle part, actually it's easier to drop it down. So, because it's a lot of work to roll things up, but it's faster if you drop things down. And so it's both a combination of it. You'll see the middle part drop and the ends then sort of roll together. As the edges roll together, they're going to make a tube, and this is called a neural tube. Inside the tube, the cells are going to grow, are going to become neurons and glial cells. Outside of the tube is just the rest of the body. So this closed tube is going to be our neural tube. Now, if the tube doesn't close completely for some reason, you're going to have some problems. That's what spinal bifida is. It's really cool. So you take as this tube is making, the little cells pair off, and they form a zipper, and they simply go... Bump, 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 connect all the way up, like sewing or zipping up the tube. If you get to the point where it doesn't zip up all the way, that's where you have problems. You have an exposed spine, and you have things can get in and out that aren't supposed to be there.
So the two rods, after the secondary rod or first rod is built, the secondary, is that built off of the curvature, or does that make somewhere else and gets put in?
No, so they just fuse together. So the tops just roll into each other, and then they will zip up.
So they just keep growing?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mostly because the bottom falls out of it, and so they're brought closer together. The next aspect of this is our tube, sideways and top view, will have three little bulges develop on it. And these are going to be the forebrain, the midbrain, and the hindbrain. If you're looking at a little... embryo, we have a forebrain forward, midbrain in the middle, and hindbrain in the back. And this is where just to show you sort of relative comparison of where the heart is. So this is before, the heart is the first thing to develop because you have to get blood to everywhere, get oxygen and carbon dioxide, in and out of things. So this is the heart develops before the brain does. So if you're using brain activity as a measure of life, which we do at the other end when you're dying, then a beating heart in an embryo doesn't mean anything. Doesn't mean that there's life. It means that it doesn't mean it's certainly not viable by itself. You could take it out and it would be by itself. So what's going to happen is that now as the brain begins to grow, we're going to have the forebrain develop certain things, the midbrain will develop others, and the spine will come out of the hindbrain. Forebrain is going to include our cerebral cortex and pretty much everything underneath. So the cerebral cortex and the limbic system both come from the forebrain. So basal ganglia, limbic system, thalamus, hypothalamus, all that comes from the forebrain. The midbrain is sort of a transition between the first and the last stuff, right? Because the midbrain is going to be things that are like the superior and inferior colliculi. These are little things just above the spine that are take information, one for vision, superior, and the one that's under it, inferior, is for hearing. Lots of things that have to do with homeostasis and reflexes, these all come from the midbrain stuff. And then the hindbrain is going to be the part that does the medulla oblongata, the cerebellum, the pons, all the things that are directly connected to the spine. Questions on this? All right, so that's the forebrain, midbrain, and hindbrain. Now there are several phases to this process. Phase one is, we're going to work our way through, is a symmetrical thing. We start with founder cells, and the founder cells in this one are going to have identical founder cells that are going to develop left and right. They're founder cells, so you can have identical left brain, right brain thing. So the reason we have two hemispheres, well, it's because probably because of the way that it starts developing. We start with a single egg, which then cuts in half, and then each one of those cuts in half, and each one of those cuts in half, and those so on. So we always are doing things in twos. And so when we begin developing something that's going to develop into a hemisphere, there's one on the something else that had started as the pre-hemisphere is now starting as a hemisphere on the other side, and so that's why we have this very symmetrical pattern. This is where this phase here is where our radial glial cells are. Remember our little radials? Yeah. Depends on the child and which parts they're losing. But yeah, if it's early enough, the development can occur on one side because there's no other place for it to develop. But we're earlier than that. We're at the point now where we're simply starting with glial cells. And the glial cells spread out like a tree. And then the neurons, the little dots here, are neurons climbing the glial tree. Then they climb it to find their proper place, and then the glial structure has created the places that all the neurons go to. The second phase after this initial part is asymmetrical, where the founder cells and the neurons are now have separate paths. Founder cells will continue to do some things, and then they will begin to, we're at about 3 months after fertilization. And so things will divide into neurons and founder cells. The founder cells will continue for a bit, and then they're going to receive a signal, and they're all going to die off. And hopefully, the rest of the cells, the neurons, don't die off. Sometimes they get the same signal, and which is not good. So the end of cortical development at about all the structure is complete by 3 or 4 months. Now the founder cells will disappear, and all you're left with is the neurons themselves. This killing off of the founder cells is called apoptosis. It's a programmed cell death, meaning that it is something that's planned. It's going to come. It's just inevitable that it will happen, like a life cycle of a founder cell is pretty short. Questions on this? During the second phase, the founder cells will die, and that's the apoptosis. Programmed cell death. It's a good word to fit in your conversation. How do you feel today? A little apoptosis. Got a touch of apoptosis today. I have anatomy, connections, and underneath. Anatomy. What do you wish to start with? Anatomy. Well, okay. Brain anatomy. We try not to put them in order for you. We want you to add things to it. Here is a brain. Or here is a brain. This front side. Easiest way to describe a brain is to do your hands as fists. And to really carry it across, you cross them. So you take your hands into a fist, you cross them. Left hemisphere runs the right side. Right hemisphere runs the left side. And each fist looks like a hemisphere, right? So we have a temporal lobe for the thumb, sticks out, kind of funny and big. We've got the four parts, the big part in the front for our frontal lobe. We have a little ridge between them, and this top of the ridge is our parietal lobe, and we have occipital lobe in the back. So every brain looks sort of like a fist, right? So we have our temporal lobe, our thumb, and the front part here is the frontal lobe. And then on the back, you'll have the top of the ridge is the parietal lobe, and then in the back, you have the occipital lobe. Occipital lobe, starting at the back, is primarily for vision. So that's its major thing. Whether you actually are seeing something or you are visualizing that you're something, you're using your occipital lobe. So your brain works on reality and unreality equally, which is interesting. It makes sense, but it's not necessarily the only way it could have developed. You could have a separate system for thinking about things, but we don't. We use the same system for experiencing things in our head as we use for experiencing outside. And so vision is our occipital one. So the eyeballs are down here, and information is going to travel, stop in a couple of places along the way, but then going to this one and back. So this is the part where you land on the back of your head, hit the head, and you see stars, or the cartoons. You hit them with a hammer, and they all go, see stars. Thing. And actually true. That is a stimulation to the occipital lobe by trauma. Can cause things that weird looking kind of signals. Because what you're doing is instead of making them fire on the basis of the neuron current coming to them, the impulse, you're kind of going bang. It's like sort of hitting your TV to get it to work. It's like, hey, come on, computer. That's what you're doing. You're physically banging it, and you'll get some response sometimes from it. Can cause which? Color blindness? Not as much. Color blindness is more on the process of getting it to the back. So it has to do with the ganglion cells that carry the information to the occipital lobe. But we'll get there. We'll come back to that. So vision in the back, sound in the temporal lobe. So the top part of the temporal lobe has three parts to it, superior, medial, and inferior, top, middle, bottom. Superior is sound, medial is memory, and inferior is vision, taking things from the occipital lobe and now processing them further in the bottom of the temporal lobe allows us to recognize objects and faces and figure out what in the world that we're looking at. So the occipital lobe is primarily, what it does is it processes the underlying stuff, all of the basics, and then it passes off to other parts of the brain to actually do the higher level processing. Sound, memory, and vision. Occipital is just vision. And so sound, memory, and high-end vision, right? The parietal lobe is one that we do touch. It has actually a couple different, we'll come back to all of these, but just want to give you one kind of thing that you can keep track of. Touch, pressure, pain. The parietal lobe's primary function is to give you a 3D view of the world. You're going to get sensory information from all the senses are going to come to the parietal lobe, but it's going to give you an idea of where you are and where everything around you is. Every time you look somewhere, the parietal lobe remaps itself. So if I look over here and I see you, my parietal lobe now has mapped all of you people and all the relationships between you and the relationship from me to you and how far away you are. When I change my gaze, it now remaps it. Sort of forgets about those people over there, but it remaps it to all the ones that are currently over here. So if I'm moving my head back and forth very rapidly, parietal lobe has to keep up with it, and it is remapping it every time you simply move your gaze. It is saying, okay, now here's where you are. Now is here where you are. It's like GPS. It's like, you are in here now in terms of relationships of everybody else. So it doesn't find, we are not good at any precise measurement. We are excellent at relative measurements. And so this is a relative thing to the parietal lobe is saying this is object is in spatially above or below, side to side, this far forward or backward, those kinds of things. we take two half maps of vision and send them to the occipital lobe when they're sort of put together. And although parietal lobe does part of this as well. And so you only have one half. If you have bad depth perception, landing planes can be real tough. That's why they put markers, though, on them. Everybody has trouble landing planes. So they have the runway with those little marks on them so you can find it. So that's the parietal lobe. Everything else is frontal. So any kind of cognition, motor movements, thinking about motor movements, planning motor movements, making decisions, thinking about making decisions, all that's frontal lobe. So the frontal lobe has a couple of things. Let's give it three general areas. One of them is the primary motor cortex. This is just in front of the cut between the frontal lobe and the parietal lobe. It also has a premotor cortex, which is just in front of that, and premotor includes the supplemental motor cortex, things that include your mirror neurons and that kind of stuff. This is where you make decisions about what you're going to do. I'm going to move my left foot. And then you send that to the primary motor cortex, and it signals the neurons fire, travel down to the spine. Spine transfers them to the muscle neurons, and it tells the foot to move. And so this includes a supplemental motor cortex in the premotor cortex and a premotor one. That's kind of the combination together. Now, the connection between the supplemental, just go back here so you can see supplemental. It connects directly to the motor cortex, connects directly to the spine, and the supplemental one does some connections directly to the spine as well. It helps you with balance, coordination, not sure exactly everything. Supplemental is where the mirror neurons are, though, so being able to watch other people and see what they do and learn from that is in this portion of it. The premotor cortex, again, also connects directly to the spine. You have some things with it. Again, not fully understood, but it has something to do with planning and spatial guidance and telling the motor cortex exactly when it's supposed to do what it's supposed to do. But the motor cortex and these pre-ones just in front of it are also influenced by the posterior part of the parietal lobe. The anterior part of the parietal lobe has to do with all the pain and temperature and all the other things we talked about. But the posterior part has to do with where you are. It's Waldo? Or Carmen Sandiego. Where in the world is Carmen Sandiego? That would be the posterior parietal lobe telling you where Carmen is. So they're associated together. So the parts just in front of the motor cortex and the part at the back of the parietal lobe all interconnect with each other by sending signals back and forth to each other. Yeah. So there's a primary motor, and then there's premotor, which includes supplemental and premotor, and then there's a prefrontal. And so this is our prefrontal. Prefrontal has three parts to it. We like everything in three parts. The whole thing is the frontal lobe. Here's the frontal lobe. We ignored all of the motor parts, got rid of those, and now we'll call this prefrontal. Now, it would be better if this was another separate lobe, easier to track, and say, oh yes, and we call it Fred. So in Fred, we have three parts to it, and then it'll be easier to remember all this. But the prefrontal cortex of the frontal lobe of the brain, it's just a long way to say it. Three parts. One of them is called dorsal lateral. Dorsal, back. Lateral, side, the back to the side. Fairly new in development. Not like last week, kind of, but, you know, fairly new. This one develops and doesn't stop developing until you're about 30. This is the last part of the brain to myelinate. It connects directly to the basal ganglia and seems to be involved in working memory. Damage to it looks a lot like schizophrenia. Drug abuse and alcohol use and a whole bunch of other things are also sort of using the dorsolateral. So what dorsolateral does, it's the place where you keep rules about rules. The other two parts, the orbital frontal and ventral medial, each have rules. The dorsolateral is the one now has keeping the rules about the rules. So it's a higher level rule manufacturer or structure. So the orbital frontal is this portion just above the orbits, above the eyes. And it's involved in decision making and inhibiting bad behavior. This is why boys behave badly and immaturely, because this doesn't develop as quickly in boys as it does in girls. So it doesn't inhibit the bad behavior, yeah. So if you blurt things out in class, that's probably because of your orbital frontal region is not, yeah. So it's also include gambling, OCD, several things we'll talk about in more detail when we get to it, but that's the orbital frontal. It's difficult to actually look at the orbital frontal one to scan it because it's close to the eyes and all the nasal passages, so you can't get a good shot of it in a brain scan. All the air around it, it makes it difficult to describe it well. Ventral medial is, you can't really see. It's on the, let me flip it over. It's this portion. So if this part here is orbital frontal, this is also orbital frontal. And in anatomically, you cannot make a distinction between orbital frontal and ventral medial. They are the same chunk of tissue. But they do slightly different rules, right? They both do kind of minor rules. The rules here have to do with risk and fear, some with decision-making, some regulation of emotion, all connected to the same time. So that's the prefrontal cortex and its triplets. So if you have rules for all kinds of things that we make decisions on, but the higher level rules, like, remember the Coke and Pepsi challenge, which they would taste test and see which one people said was best? Do you remember how that came out? Well, it depends. They both came out very well for whoever was doing the study. So what Pepsi did is it did a blind taste test, and people said, use their taste buds and their other things, sent it to the orbital frontal region, basically, and said, how's this taste? And the orbital frontal says, that's good. I like that. It's salty and it's sweet and it tastes good. Coke did a unblind taste test showing this is Coke, this is Pepsi, with our iconic Coke bottle. And everybody says, that's great. I love Coke. And that's the ventral medial part kicking in and saying, here's a brand that I know and love, has been part of my life forever. I remember as a child, you know, that I used to, you know, all that kind of stuff comes from the dorsolateral. So that's rules about rules. In the same region of this prefrontal cortex stuff going on, there is, I'll give you a side view here. So here's all of our prefrontal stuff. This thing is underneath the cortex, and it's called the corpus callosum, connects the two hemispheres together. Major white matter in it. And there's this little collar that wraps around the front part called an anterior cingulate cortex. We'll come back to all this. I'm just trying to give you the highlights. It's like the tour. On the left is the Taj Mahal, and on the right, you know, we've got a little bit of everything here for you. So just take it as initial broad strokes. The other thing that's going on here is the hippocampus. Hippocampi, one on each side. If you damage the hippocampus, if you damage one of them, you'll have some retrograde amnesia. I don't remember what happened just before the crash. If you damage both of them, I don't remember what happened after the crash. And if you damage it bilaterally, majorly, that's the antegrade amnesia where I can no longer learn new things because all I have is my working memory and none of that matters. It's not passing it on to anything. Let's give you kind of, we talked about the bottom of the temporal lobe where we have there's a linguis gyrus. Gyrus is the bulge part. The sulcuses are the dips, the valleys. So there's one for language, lingual kinds of things. There's the fusiform gyrus, which I just love as a name, where it does face recognition. And then there's just above it, there's one that's hippocampal because the hippocampus sits on top of it and interconnects there. This hippocampus looks like a sort of a C, maybe an S, because it sort of comes back, sits on its foot a bit. But I think of them as C's because you can't see the foot part coming back very easily. But they're bent toward each other. So they start in the temporal lobe, and then it bends and hits goes through the prefrontal cortex. So it runs through all that stuff that we were talking about and sits, goes through it all. And then that's where the hippocampi lie. So we use the hippocampi to move things from short-term to long-term memory. It's also involved in spatial memory. So the parietal lobe connects very directly to the hippocampus and allows you to find your way around. So if you drive for Uber or Lyft or cabs, you become really good at figuring out where everything is. That's because your hippocampus is getting bigger. It has more things stored about where things are located and how to relate them to each other. Yeah. Directly, yes, because it's hidden inside the head. But shaking it, no. Car crashes often shake it, and people don't remember what happened just before the crash. It's got a lot of things going on. If you asked the survivors of the weekend about it, they're probably going to have some gaps on both sides of whatever went on. They're probably not going to remember it continuously because they're not giving enough time for things to settle down. It's actually one of the reasons that eyewitnesses get better over time. You would think, and some people try to do this, that the police will interview you early on, and this is, well, I want your first impressions before anything happens. But our memories take a while to consolidate. And so about a week later, well, we're actually better witnesses than we were at the beginning part, assuming no one has messed with us in the middle part, right, where we didn't see any news, we didn't have any interpretations. That's much harder to do nowadays. All right, so that's the hippocampus. Remember, we'll come back to him or her. And there's a difference between men and women when it comes to hippocampi. There aren't a lot of differences in the brain. This is one. The cerebellum sits at the bottom behind your extra brain. So it does the coordination things. I have a friend whose cerebellum began to deteriorate, and it's really sad, the atrophy of the cerebellum. There's just, you need your cerebellum. Treat your cerebellum well, because it's one of the things that you really, really helpful. To get from the motor cortex down toward the spine, there's a couple of pathways. There's a lateral cortical spinal tract. These are axons from the primary motor cortex. And they stop along the way at the little red nucleus of the midbrain. Isn't that just funny to have something red in your head? It's something that aids in the coordination of motor activity. And so it's a lateral one, goes down to the medulla, and then things cross at the medulla from left to right. Remember we talked about the one hemisphere running the other side? Well, how do you get the signal from one side to the other? For most things, it runs down to the medulla on the same side and crosses at the medulla to the other side. It goes down the spine from that way. So now we're just going from the motor cortex down to the spine. And we're stopping at the medulla on the way to transfer to the other sides. This is where we get the contralateral things. We're going to cross contralaterally to the other side. We're doing this at the medulla pyramids. Told you that it was like a, and on your right, here's the medulla pyramid. We will come back to these terms. I just want to kind of give you a feeling for the for them. Questions? Ventral medial is anatomically the same part of the orbital frontal, but it's more on the inside. But it does sort of the same things that is involved in decision making and emotion, but it has different connections to the amygdala than the orbital frontal one does. Shall we do some connections? Go back to our little neurons. How do neurons reach home? Remember, they climbed our little glial tree in order to find a spot to be in. Neurons have to connect with each other, just as a reminder. We talked about an individual neuron. We spent a lot of time figuring out how one works. But they have to have a friend. They must connect, or they'll die. So as they're growing and they're climbing the glial tree, they grow axons as they're traveling up, and then they form a synapse when they get to the right spot with whoever neurons happen to be there before them. And then there's going to be some elimination on the, but we're going to start with this proliferation stage. Five stages for you. Proliferation is production of new cells. Right, so this is where cells along the ventricles, the holes in your head, divide and they become neurons and glials. The glials grow out and the neurons travel up them in order to get there. That's called, the traveling part is called migration. This is where the primitive neurons find their spots. And they do it through chemical guides, which we'll come back to. But there's chemicals in, will make some neurons, certain neurons go one way and other neurons go another way. So they're not just wandering everybody to where they want to go. There's a predisposition to end up at where they're going to be. Once they get there, they will differentiate more. If you stop them or along their growth, or you, when they first get there, if you transplant them to another part of the brain, they will just become part of that brain, just the that portion of it. But if you wait and they make friends, now when you transfer them, they're going to act like they were out of place. And then we'll talk about some of the early studies showing what you can transplant and what you can't. So the neurons get axons, they get dendrites, and that's what makes them different. Because they have different kinds of axons, different kinds of dendrites. So the axons grow before the dendrites do, because the axons are actually growing during migration. The next stage, of course, is myelination. The little glial cells that produce myelin, first in the spinal cord, then in the brain, and then finally in the dorsolateral region by the time you reach 30. And the last part, synaptogenesis, making synapses. This is a lifelong thing. Forming synapses is something you do all the time. You may think of it like having your own erector set, right? And you make some structure, lots of Lego, and then you break it down and build it up and break it down and build it up. You're always building something new. And that's what we're doing with our synapses.